You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tighe Enright and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Raffaella Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute. What do you have for us today?
Well, today we're going to be talking about a very senior Chinese official, Zhou Yongkang, who's been brought down. We're going to talk about more violence in Xinjiang, Western China, and we're going to talk about Afghanistan and the Australians who are off this year.
More from Raff in a moment. Also ahead, Chileans went to the polls over the weekend and former leader Michelle Bachelet came out on top.
Gracias por este privilegio, por esta cercanía, por ese apoyo, por esta nación que hoy alumbran ustedes.
And just how scary is Patrick Bateman in Song? Bret Easton Ellis's iconic book American Psycho has been adapted as a stage musical.
This was a classic case of me thinking in advance, I don't know. But what I hadn't counted on was that there's real substance and grit here.
We'll get critic Matt Wolfe's opinion on that, and we'll play some music too. All to come in the next hour, here on Midori House.
First, though, David Spencer has the world news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Michelle Bachelet has won a second term as president of Chile. The left-wing candidate won nearly two-thirds of the vote in the country's election runoff. Bachelet last led the country in 2010 and has pushed an agenda which involves raising corporate taxes to 25% from 20%, which would pay for social reforms that include a gradual move to free higher education. She also wants to change the Pinochet-era constitution and electoral system. A Brazilian judge has ordered a halt to construction on one of the stadiums being built for the Football World Cup the day after a worker died there. Public prosecutors made the move pending guarantees from the company involved in the work about workers' safety. There have now been five deaths during construction projects for next year's high-profile tournament. At least 22 people have been killed after a bus crashed off an elevated motorway onto a delivery van in the Philippine capital Manila. Investigators are trying to establish the cause of the accident, but some witnesses describe the vehicle speeding in bad weather. A number of people were also injured. The Irish Prime Minister says the country's exit from its EU-IMF bailout has restored national pride and set the stage for a swift recovery. Enda Kenny was speaking as Ireland's exit was officially confirmed, a move that has been hailed by EU leaders as an indication that austerity works. It's the first Eurozone country to leave a bailout. Unemployment has fallen below 13% from a 15.1% peak in 2012, and property prices have started to rebound. But Brian Lucy, a professor of finance at Trinity College in Dublin, has told us the politicians are probably the only ones happy at this stage.
Psychologically, it's nice that we're no longer fully under the control of others, but it's not going to make any difference to people on Monday morning. It's not going to make any difference really to the budget next year or the following year. It's not going to make any great difference to how people live their lives or how companies do their jobs.
A conservation group says it's prepared for increased aggression from Japanese whalers as it begins its annual bid to stop them. Three ships belonging to Sea Shepherd have left Australia for Antarctica to try to stop the Japanese whaling fleet. Six speedboats and a helicopter will also be used by the group during the operation. Siddhar Charavati is captain of one of the ships.
The only thing that stands between the whaling fleet and the whales being killed is us. Over the last 10 years, we've gone down each year stronger, and this year we finally got a fleet that can match the Japanese whaling fleet.
Oscar-winning actress Joan Fontaine has died aged 96 at her home in California. She was best known for her roles in psychological thrillers produced by Alfred Hitchcock, including Suspicion, for which she won an Oscar. Tributes have also been paid to the Irish-born actor Peter O'Toole, who has passed away aged 81. He starred in the Oscar-winning Lawrence of Arabia and was nominated eight times for an Oscar. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much to David Spencer. Right, it's 5 minutes past the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Time now for us to set the day's agenda with a look at some of the top stories for the next 24 hours. Joining us here in the studio is Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome back to the programme, Raffaello.
Thank you, Doug.
The first story you want to talk to us about today is the indictment of a leading former Chinese official for graft.
So this is a story that has been bubbling along for quite a few months now, frankly, since Xi Jinping's come into power. There's been a sort of anti-corruption drive. And what we've seen is we've seen a number of very senior figures within the party being sort of brought down. And what's interesting is that it seemed that they all seem to be coming from a similar faction. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party is, you know, all one monolithic entity of like 80 million people. However, within this, there are all sorts of power factions and groups. And the one faction they all seem to be winding back to was this figure, Zhou Yongkang, who was a former member of the Politburo, and who was described as being the sort of third most important member of the group in the previous Hu Jintao administration. He was the man responsible for the security apparatus, and he came from a long history of working in the oil industry previously. He was like a manager or CEO at CNPC, the state-owned company. And what we've been seeing is we've been hearing these rumors that there was maybe the corruption charges are going to reach all the way up to him. And it now seems that the New York Times has finally managed to nail this down with about five different sources, some official, claiming that there is an investigation going underway, and it looks like it's really going to be looking at anti-corruption, potentially looking at charges posted against him. Now, it's difficult to underestimate how important this is. I mean, this is a really big deal. This is like saying, you know, it's as though you had a sort of a cabinet level minister of the former administration being torn down. It's similar in some ways to what we've just been seeing happening in DPRK.
So it's the first time, really, that an official who's held such high office has actually had facing formal corruption charges.
Exactly right.
Normally, it's done through the party. I mean, it goes party apparatus first, but this is now.
Well, this is happening in that same way as well. But the point is, it's never reached this high. We've seen very senior figures within the party being brought down. We saw Bo Xilai come down last year, but he never actually made it to the Politburo. The Politburo is the sort of the men who rule China. You know, you have the sort of the leader, Xi Jinping, and then there's a little coterie around him, and those are the guys who rule this entire country. And we've never seen before in the sort of history of the party someone from that group who has not only been through but actually left office being then torn down subsequently. Usually, once you get there, the assumption is that you're pretty much safe. You know, that's it. You're above all these sorts of potential charges and corruption allegations.
So why do you think this is a priority for Xi Jinping? I mean, is he trying to ward off some kind of a Chinese spring, as it were, by rooting out bad behavior in public office?
Well, I mean, there's kind of... This is the difficult part, and this is when Chinese politics becomes so difficult and opaque, is that it's hard to tell if, you know, Xi Jinping has been talking about wanting to swat what he calls tigers and flies, right? He thinks the flies are the sort of little corrupt officials at a sort of lower local level, but the tigers are the sort of the big tigers of the party who are behind a lot of these giant sort of corruption deals and allegations that we see happening. And, you know, bringing this person down, one could say he's definitely bringing down a tiger, you know, a very senior figure within the party. However, there is also a more cynical edge to this, which says that if we look at a lot of the corruption charges that have gone on in the past year, they have been targeted at people at this faction. And there is a discussion that goes that this faction is one that's kind of fallen out of favor. And so maybe we're just seeing a sort of more traditional, you know, sort of medieval politics playing out within the sort of Chinese body politic. It is frankly very difficult to know, but I don't think I think nonetheless the fact that he's been willing to let this discussion and these charges get to such a high level, you know, this means that basically anyone in the current Politburo could also be investigated because that threshold's now been set that high.
Is he playing a dangerous game? I mean, if the case falters or for some reason doesn't go forward, he's possibly jeopardizing the unity amongst the elite.
He certainly is, and he's not only jeopardizing the unity amongst the elite, but he's also setting a precedent. I mean, we may remember earlier this year, Bloomberg wrote a piece that was very controversial about Xi Jinping's family and the allegations of corruption and the amount of money that they'd been making around it. From this New York Times story, we can see that a lot of the allegations around Zhou Yongkang are focused around his wife and his child. And so there's a risk here for Xi Jinping in that he's setting a precedent that could then be followed potentially against him.
And I guess if he wanted to show that he was tough on corruption, this investigation might be a little bit more overt, do you think? Rather than having the New York Times having to chase around five independent sources who spoke on condition of anonymity.
Well, I mean, I think it's one that has to be handled very carefully. And I mean, if you read the tea leaves of the past year, as I say, the cases that we've seen going in the past, they're all people who served under him and served in important positions under him. So we can see that it's been going in this direction. And, you know, people have been speculating for some time that his head has potentially been on the block. But this is the first time we've had sort of official confirmation. I think what we should probably see, and I would guesstimate in the early months of the next year, we should get official confirmation from the party in some way. And I think that will be a very important moment.
Ralph, let's stay in China and indeed in one region of China where there are two separate stories coming out of there. Let's look first at a terror attack. Tell us about this.
Yes, so this is an incident that's taken place just south of Kashgar. It looks like it happened sometime last night. There seems to have been some sort of ill-defined at this point terrorist incident, as the local authorities are describing it, in which a group of bomb-wielding and machete sort of waving men attacked local authorities. It appears there's somewhere in the region of 16 or so dead. This incident is, you know, we've seen, frankly, this story repeatedly over the past year, where we've had these sorts of low-level clashes between groups of Uyghurs. And, you know, Xinjiang is this giant sixth of China's landmass that is torn by this ethnic strife between a Uyghur minority and a Han majority. I mean, Han is what we'd sort of all consider Chinese sort of people to look like. Uyghurs look more sort of Turkic Central Asian. And they've had these sorts of clashes in the past year. The Uyghurs believe that the Han are coming in and taking over their territory, and it often erupts into violence. And we've seen this incident in Xinjiang, this particular one just south of Kashgar. This is, I think it's almost the 10th we've seen this year so far. And the casualties that we're talking about is up near 150 or so, which is, you know, getting to be a pretty substantial number of people. I mean, every year we have a certain amount of these incidents, but this year seems to have been particularly bloody. And we might remember early in the year there was this incident in Tiananmen Square when a group of Uyghurs, for unspecified reasons, drove their jeep into a crowd of tourists in the middle of Tiananmen Square under the famous Mao picture in the middle. You know, the violence in Xinjiang isn't getting any better. And I think this year has just been evidence of the fact that whatever the Chinese government is doing out there doesn't seem to be working. In fact, it potentially is making the situation even worse.
Well, I know a kind of a national security, kind of an anti-terror council was part of Xi Jinping's recent five-year plan. I just wonder, though, is there some subtlety to be read into the fact that in this write-up of that story in the South China Morning Post, terror attack is put in inverted commas?
Well, I mean, you know, we have to remember that the South China Morning Post here is reporting from Tianshan.com, which is the sort of Xinjiang authorities report. So the skepticism that we're seeing in the inverted commas is something that maybe the SCMP is putting on it rather than the Chinese authorities. So I think we have to be right there. But, you know, it's very difficult. I mean, Chinese people have had a number of discussions with the Chinese friends and colleagues about these incidents in Xinjiang, and they're sort of appalled that there's any hesitation in the West to target them as terrorist incidents. And, you know, in many ways, it's hard to see why not. I mean, these are groups of people who are non-state actors launching an attack against the state or against civilians who they believe are affiliated with the state. That seems like a terrorist incident to me.
Dictionary definition, yeah.
Yeah.
Ralph, let's stay in the same region and have a look at this gas explosion.
Yes, this is a story. This is another depressing tale that we've seen repeatedly, or sort of all over China, where we've had a sort of incidence of violent incidents of coal mining or gas mains that have sort of erupted and killed a huge number of people. So this is, you know, Xinjiang not only is home to this terrible restive violence between two groups, it's also home to, I think it's somewhere in the region of 40 or 50% of China's coal. And China uses coal as to generate about 70% of its electricity. So it's a hugely important commodity for them. Depressingly, a lot of the coal mines around the country are very, very badly regulated. And we see regularly that dozens of people will die in these horrible accidents. Mm.
And the fact that there have been so many, as you've just been talking about, I mean, has that created some level of a push to improve safety standards?
I mean, we've seen so many of these incidents in China in the past few years that why this one would trigger it, I'm uncertain. However, you know, there has been an attempt by the government in some other provinces, in Shanxi, for example, which is home to a lot of coal. That has been a place where they have tried to have a push to try to regulate some things. But the problem is that it's not only sort of big state-owned coal mines that is the problem. There's lots of smaller ones because the coal is quite close to the surface. So it's easy for your average farmer to decide, oh, well, you know, turn my piece of land into a coal mine and start digging. But that slowly over time comes deeper. They don't have the same safety regulations and it sort of collapses.
Mm. Raf, finally, we're going to go on to Australia and the last troops leaving their Afghan base.
Yes, this is, I think, a story which is more a sort of year in preview story, I think, is the fact that we've got the Australian forces are closing down and drawing down from their base in Uruzgan in Afghanistan. The Aussies have maintained a permanent presence at the Tarinkot base since 2005, and there are still admittedly going to be a few Aussie soldiers who are going to stay behind serving as trainers. I think it's at the British-run, what's called Sandhurst in the Sand, just outside Kabul. But basically, this is a story which we're going to see rolling on through the year as it goes on, as basically most of the Western forces are going to pull out. We've got a whole debate about what's going to happen about the remaining American forces, whether the BSA, the bilateral security agreement that they will or will not sign with the Afghans, will go ahead. And that will determine sort of the shape of the Western force to come. But I think this is a story which we're going to see in the year going forward. And it's going to be an interesting question to see what happens with Afghanistan after that.
Indeed, I suppose a lot of questions will be asked is if the domestic forces are ready to be defend themselves, defend the country by themselves, but also whether the government, without the presence of Western forces, will start drifting back towards somewhat more extremist policies.
Well, I think the government around Karzai will probably stay much as we're going to see it. The question becomes how much of the country are they able to control, and how much of the armed forces, the 350,000 ANSF forces there are, will remain loyal to them. I was in Kabul earlier this year, and it was interesting to see how people on the ground are concerned about not only the Taliban coming back, but they're concerned about growing warlordism. And you have seen over this past year that different sort of regional leaders have started to rearm their forces. In the north, you've sort of got Dostum and Atta, who have started to, you know, basically take control of a piece of territory. And it's going to be very interesting to see whether this country sort of stays together as a whole, or whether we see it degenerate back to the sort of warlordism that we saw pre-9/11.
Raf, thanks very much indeed for coming on. As you say, this is something that we'll be looking at really for the next year. Mm-hmm. Raffaella Pantucci from RUSI, thanks for joining us.
Coming up, Chile has decided.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with Midori House. Next, we go to Chile, which has looked to history for its next president. Michelle Bachelet, the centre-left former president, has been returned to power in a runoff vote in which she decisively trumped her rival, Evelyn Matthei.
And Matthei suffered from her family's association with former dictator Augusto Pinochet, but also from weariness of right-wing politics, despite a period of record low unemployment and economic growth. The incumbent president, billionaire Sebastián Piñera, has telephoned Bachelet to congratulate her on her victory. Well, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, who's a Chilean expert and the author of Story of a Death Foretold, The Coup Against Salvador Allende, joins us now. Thanks so much for coming in, Oscar. Firstly, your book, of course, gives us all the backstory that we need on this.
And indeed, we need backstory for this because this is the first time after 43 years that a socialist physician is made president of Chile yet again. But it's also very important to make the comparison between what happened back in the 1970s and what is happening now in terms of people's response to the election. Back in the 1970s, Allende, and if you add up the Christian Democrats, obtained close to 62%, exactly the same figure that was obtained by the coalition that includes the Socialists, the Communists, and Christian Democrats behind Michelle Bachelet in Chile. But back then, the turnout was pretty high. Right now, the turnout was very low, and there is a serious question there. What happened in between these two eras? Well, the dictatorship. And there you have the reason for the loss of confidence, particularly among the youngest people in Chile.
Was this so much a vote for the left, or was it a vote against someone seen as a descendant of Pinochet?
I think these two things go together. It was a vote for the left, not so much against vote against someone who could be seen as close to Pinochet, although of course that is the case, but is more an action against a model that is seen as completely exhausted. This dual structure, which includes both the so-called neoliberal economic model and the protected democracy model, this binomial electoral system, is precisely what people are voting against.
But voters were presented with a very black and white choice, effectively, between voting for someone with links with Pinochet and someone whose family suffered at the hands of Pinochet. It was very much a black and white choice between two candidates who had very diametrically opposed experiences of the regime.
Which is particularly interesting, given that the two candidates had actually a very similar biography. You know, they were born in the same region, they were childhood friends, both their parents were in the Air Force. But of course, that's where the similarities end. At some point after the military coup, you have General Alberto Bachelet, Michel's father, being tortured in an office not too far from the office where General Mathei, Evelyn Mathei's father, was doing his work. And it is known that he never complained about these injustices. So, of course, the Chilean electorate is identifying both with starkly different choices. But they mostly represent a choice of two very different political and economic models. And the fact that you had 62% of those who voted going for the coalition, a coalition that is presenting a manifesto which is far more radical than the one that Michel Bachelet presented the first time around, and also these close to 60% of the population that did not vote out of distrust for the system, a system that, since the dictatorship, systematically eliminated militant political parties and dismissed politics as a reproachable activity. That system, in the 1990s, you see young people not inscribing themselves in the electoral roll precisely in order to raise their voices against it. And that's what you see in Chile. And it's not just a Chilean problem. I'm afraid we're going to see a very similar problem in Europe, particularly here in the UK, if you judge the way in which young people are being treated right now.
What do you think Bachelet's first priority is going to be?
Three very clear priorities. Number one, a new constitution that was not only part of what the social movements which supported her, particularly the student movement, asked from her, but many Chilean voters did inscribe the letters A and C, meaning a call for a national constitutional assembly. Second, education, free and high quality higher education. This, and if it works in Chile, that is going to also have an impact elsewhere in the world. We know that the next economic crisis in Europe and in North America is very likely to be tied up to student debt. Thirdly, precisely, to rekindle the trust that those who did not vote have in democracy.
Okay, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you very much for joining us here on the Midori House.
It's time now for us to get a check of the top stories in one part of the world. Well, today we're heading to New Zealand. Joining us from Auckland is our man there, Simon Farrell-Green. Hi, Simon.
Hi, how are you?
We're so good here, although much, much colder than you are there, I imagine.
Yeah, yes, it's getting very hot here. It's one of the warmest Decembers on record, so we're hitting 27 degrees most days.
Why do we have these people on the programme?
You tease us.
I tell you. The first story you want to talk to us is about an rather badly behaved mayor of Auckland.
Yeah, this is actually a very sad story. We've covered a lot to do with Len Brown in the past 4 years. He was the first mayor of the Auckland Super City, which was the big amalgamated city. And for the first term, he earned huge praise, really, for uniting the city and coming up with a pretty good program to put Auckland where it needs to be. But just after he was re-elected in November, details emerged of a long-running affair he'd had with a 30-year-old woman of Chinese origin in Auckland, which in and of itself is not necessarily, reasons for him not to be the mayor. It was a private matter, but it did launch an inquiry into his expenses, which has put him squarely in trouble.
And the city's going to be horribly affected, I mean, if he goes for this.
Yeah, he won't go. It's still not enough to really for him to be forced to resign or to be removed. Basically what he's done is accepted $39,000 worth of free hotels or hotel upgrades. They were, in fact, hotels that he had paid for privately when he had to stay in the city. He lives quite far south. So, again, it's not a corruption thing. It's just not a good look. And it's a distraction.
Just talk to us a little bit more about what he's actually accused of accepting. I mean, you talk about having paid for hotel rooms by himself out of his own pocket, but been given a free upgrade because he's the mayor. I mean, pardon me for being a little bit underwhelmed.
I think what you need to do probably is put it into the context of New Zealand. I mean, we are probably one of the least corrupt countries in the world. These sorts of things do count for scandal here. We expect a great deal of our politicians in terms of honesty and in terms of being straightforward and not accepting these sorts of things. I think in the case of one particular hotel, it is problematic in the sense that it's a casino hotel called Sky City, which at the time was lobbying quite heavily for an extension to its license. So that's also not particularly intelligent to be accepting free hotel rooms from.
True enough, Simon, you've convinced me now. And talking about another interesting aspect of New Zealand democracy, the next story you want to talk to us is about privatisation of state companies and a referendum commissioned by citizens, which has the outcome of which has been against this privatisation. I'm quite interested in how citizens can commission their own referendum.
Yeah, it's one of the peculiarities of the New Zealand electoral system. We can have a citizen-initiated referendum if a certain number of people sign a petition. I'm afraid that I don't have the exact numbers to hand, but it's something like 50 or 100,000 people, which is a pretty big ask in a country of 4 million. So if that many people sign it, then it goes to a public vote, which it did last week.
And the issue at hand?
The issue at hand is whether or not to carry on with the national government's reasonably controversial asset sales program. Basically, it's a number of power companies in particular, which have very large hydro dam holdings in the South Island, and the government proposed to sell down up to 49% of those state-owned power companies, and has done so with two already. They got a lot less than they probably could have or should have if they'd waited. So it hasn't been the most popular of programs, but John Key's come out and said that the referendum was a publicity stunt and he'll be carrying on regardless.
Simon Farrell-Green speaking to us from Auckland, New Zealand. Thank you very much indeed.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Essa é a Monaco 24.
From London.
In London.
London, cara.
De Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be flicking through this morning's front pages and we'll sample some of Belgrade's offering from the rock and roll sphere.
Generally, artists will be pushing further east every year. But then there's the problem of lower ticket prices as you move east.
But first, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Michelle Bachelet has won Chile's runoff election to become president for a second time. Her rival, Evelyn Matthei, conceded defeat after producing the right's worst performance in two decades. Bachelet wants Chile to increase taxes and also provide free higher education. A Brazilian judge has ordered a halt to construction work on a stadium being built for 2014's Football World Cup. The move follows the death of a worker at Manaus on Saturday, the fifth such incident at stadiums being built for the tournament. Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny has warned there is still some way for Ireland to go, despite officially exiting its bailout. In a televised address, he said the move had restored national pride and set the stage for a swift recovery. South Korea has warned of what the president called possible reckless provocations by the North. The warning comes after the shock execution of leader Kim Jong-un's uncle, Chang Song-taek, last week. Israel says one of its soldiers has been killed after a Lebanese sniper opened fire in a border area. A UN peacekeeping force said it was working with both sides to stop the incident from escalating. A conservation campaign group has set sail from Australia for its annual confrontation with the Japanese whaling fleet in the Southern Ocean. Members of Sea Shepherd are leaving Melbourne for what they've dubbed Operation Relentless. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David Spencer. You're listening to Midori House here from here in London, where the time now is 8:31. For a long time, Belgrade was well and truly off the rock and roll map. Serbia's capital went through conflict and international embargoes in the 90s, and economic woes followed in the new millennium. All a real blow to people who'd grown up with Western music, thanks to Yugoslavia's enthusiastic embrace of sounds banned in other communist countries.
But now the bands are coming back to Belgrade with a vengeance. In the past year, arena fillers like Beyoncé, Depeche Mode and Peter Gabriel have made their first visit. And smaller venues have been hosting the likes of Lloyd Cole, Public Image Limited and Mark Lanigan. Now the government is hoping to use music to attract more international visitors to Serbia and change the country's image for the better. So how does a nation go about putting itself back on the touring map? Well, Monocle's Balkans correspondent Guy Delaney faces the music for this week's edition of Culture.
For decades, if you lived in Belgrade, this was about as close as you could get to hearing Peter Gabriel play live. A concert album that came out 30 years ago is no substitute for the real thing, but since the breakup of Yugoslavia, the musically inclined citizens of Belgrade have become used to slim pickings. Major acts struck Serbia's capital off their schedules as international embargoes and economic woes took their toll. But in the past year or so, things have started to change, and Peter Gabriel was just one of the big names who played their first shows in post-breakup Belgrade.
Promoters will only put things on if they think they can make some money at it, and artists will then come so that they can make a bit of money too.
David Rhodes has been playing guitar with Peter Gabriel for more than three decades.
In this case, Peter's management, he'll look at the map and the gigs that he knows we can get, Milan, Vienna, whatever, and then he'll go, well, perhaps we could head down into Serbia or Croatia or whatever. And so then he'll look for offers from those territories. And if the offers work out, if the promoters feel that they can make it work, then artists will add that territory to the circuit.
I am John and I was born in London. I am no vulture, this is my culture.
John Lydon's Public Image Limited were among the other visitors in what turned out to be a bumper year for Belgrade's gig-goers. There was pop glamour as Beyoncé opened her world tour here, industrial gloom as Depeche Mode played an enormous outdoor show, and Green Day stayed out of rehab long enough to rock out at the foot of Belgrade's ancient Riverside Fortress. So why are all these high-profile visitors putting Belgrade back on the international musical map? David Rhodes admits the changing economics of the music industry may have had an influence on the influx.
If you're not doing shows, you're losing money. and a lot.
Are you finding yourself as a working musician now playing not just
playing
in,
more
and in new in different places?
Yes, and I think that generally artists will be pushing further east every year. But then there's the problem of lower ticket prices as you move east.
You only have to stroll down Belgrade's main pedestrian drag to see how much music means to people here. There are posters plastered on every available surface advertising upcoming gigs. There's everyone from dance DJ Dave Clark to rock dinosaurs Deep Purple, plus a plethora of local acts. So it's easy to imagine how frustrating it was to live through the years when the city was off limits to international tours.
When, for example, Depeche Mode came and all of those people, I don't know how many thousands of them, it was like, oh, if after 10 years or something, we won for the first time.
Valentina Matsura organised Belgrade's Parallel Festival, and she's got a prescription for making sure the city continues on its musical upswing.
Better conditions from our country and government for us who are organising those artists. I suppose it would be very important to look at pop culture at the other way, because if you don't invest in culture and pop culture, you won't have products from it, and also you won't have successful artists coming.
I don't mind the flowers and the trees. I don't mind the birds and I don't mind the bees.
Valentina's efforts were certainly appreciated by Lloyd Cole. The British singer-songwriter's sell-out gig at the Parallel Festival marked the first time he'd played in the Balkans.
This is the only concert that I'm playing this year in a city that I haven't been to before. There's a whole block of the world that starts somewhere close to where the old Iron Curtain used to be and goes all the way to Japan that I've almost never been. And from a selfish point of view, I'd be excited to try and go to new places. I mean, I'm certainly, you know, I'm not Peter Gabriel.
Quite apart from helping out hard-up artists, there's a growing realisation here that music could play a part in Serbia's rebranding as it moves from isolation towards membership of the European Union. The Exit Festival in Novi Sad has been pulling in the punters for years, but attracting international visitors to gigs in the capital could have an even bigger impact. Cultural diplomacy could go a long way to improving the country's image, and Prime Minister Ivica Dačić says his government wants to make it easier and more attractive for big-name acts to come here.
Well, I think that it all greatly contributes to strengthening the position of our country, and a huge number of people from abroad, foreigners, who come here, who can see for themselves the way of living we are living here, and the mentality of our people, so the huge number of them comes to love our people.
And if any further encouragement were needed, it's worth pointing out that ticket prices remain extremely reasonable in Belgrade, about €13 to see Lloyd Cole and €30 for Peter Gabriel's live spectacular. The beer's cheap too, everything you need for a European gig weekend, in fact. But don't tell everyone, okay? For Monocle, in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
You're listening to Midori Hirst. We'll be back right after this to hear the verdict on the stage version of American Psycho.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question.
Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:40 here in London. It's sellout season in theatreland, and London is embracing the trend for big ticket names to tread the boards. It's bringing new audiences and showcasing interesting new directors. One of the highlights of the season is the stage version of the iconic book American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. Our regular theatre critic Matt Wolff gave his verdict to Emma Nelson.
I thought American Psycho was terrific, and I have to say, expectations in the theatre exist to be confounded. This was a classic case of me thinking in advance, I don't know, it's going to be very glib, it's going to be very, brand name intensive, it's going to be a blank treatment of societal blankness, and that actually wears thin after about 10 minutes. But what I hadn't counted on was that there's real substance and grit here. And I also didn't realize that Matt Smith had the acting chops that he has to make Patrick Bateman not just a sort of avatar of soullessness, but something, there's something within him that he's fighting. You feel throughout the entire performance this kind of push me, pull you. He's drawn to slaughter, but at the same time, he wants to stop himself and he just can't.
American Psycho, the book, I remember when it came out and reading it and not quite getting it, and then having to go back about 10 years later and read it and think, my goodness, this was the first really serious critique of branding, of a world that we'd all fallen into, the soulless sort of the love of the brand, the obsession with brands. It's a very cold and very detached and very, very bloody book, and the last piece of work I had ever thought would translate into a musical. How do they do it successfully?
Well, they do it by Rupert Gould as the director, who now runs the Almeida, I think it's important to say. So this is an important kind of clarion call for his Almeida regime. They do it largely by finding a kind of realism which isn't exactly real. So the whole thing, you wouldn't call it surreal, but it's slightly at a sidelong angle from reality, just as Patrick Bateman is at a sidelong angle from the world he inhabits. And there's a very interesting suggestion in the show, come the finale, which I won't give away, that in a way it doesn't really matter who Patrick Bateman is. He could be any of us. He doesn't really get a comeuppance in the show. And the suggestion at the end is that the Patrick Batemans of the world walk amongst us. Well, that's absolutely true. All you need to do is read the newspaper on a daily basis, and you read these sort of horrific stories about men and women who are Patrick Batemans in everything but name.
The American Psycho is probably meant to be one of the most. It's horror. It's gore. I found the musical very funny, very funny. But funny because it was clever in that it was reflecting a decade that had so much in it to reflect.
Yes, and it's funny because it acknowledges the absurdity of what it's acknowledging. So, for instance, there's a thing about, let's peer into the existential abyss while we're shopping at Bloomingdale's. So you get the brand name reference, but you also get something about the absolute sort of terror, the psychic terror at the heart of it. Matt Smith is no singer, but even his lack of vocal kind of skill works for the part. There's something other about him, which is exactly what the part needs.
Let's have a listen.
But let's be clear, there's nothing ironic about our love of Manolo Blahnik. No, there's nothing remotely ironic about our love of Manolo Blahnik.
was Matt Wolff's review there of The American Psycho, the musical, speaking to Emma Nelson. And our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's popped into the studio, is going to be taking us through the Brazilian front pages in a few minutes. But you saw it. What did you think?
I thought it was extremely fun. I had more fun watching the stage version than the film, I have to say. It's like watching like an 80s electropop musical made by Giorgio Moroder and his campus moments. Yeah, it's just fantastic.
That song was fabulous,
wasn't
it?
It's fabulous. And that's, I mean, there are many others. I mean, when you see the way the stage is made, it's just incredible. And I think Matt Smith gave a good performance as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of musicals, perhaps, for instance, Andrew Lloyd Webber's new musical, which is just opened now, getting quite bad reviews, we think this is on the cards for it. Matt was saying that these musicals open at this time if people are unsure of how they're going to go. But you seem to think that that's not the case at all.
It's not the case. I mean, the show sold out until the February. And actually, I think it might go to the West End and even to Broadway because it is quite successful. And I think it worked on stage.
There we go. Well, go along, make up your own mind if you're in town. We'll be, staying on the American Psycho theme before we go to the Brazilian front pages. Here is a bit of music from the soundtrack of the film. It's Information Society with What's On Your Mind.
I want to know what you're thinking. There are some things you can't hide. I want to know what you're feeling. Tell me what's on your mind.
Continuing American Psycho's electro pop from the 80s theme, that was Information Society with What's On Your Mind.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin, and Tyke Enright. Well, joining us now in the studio, again, still, Monocle's Fernando Augusto.
Can't get rid of him.
Well, he was talking about American Psycho earlier. Now he's talking about South America. You're giving us the Latin American papers. So tell us what's up first.
Well, I think we should start with Folha de São Paulo. I know we spoke earlier on the show with Oscar Rivera about the fact that Michelle Bachelet won in Chile. But I just want to give the Brazilian twist to it, you know, because, you know, our former president, Lula da Silva, he went to Chile actually to campaign for Bachelet. And you know, some people say that he's got kind of the magic touch as well. I think he worked again. And it's interesting to notice as well that Bachelet has a very close relationship with the governments of Argentina and Brazil. And you know, Chile is in a very interesting position, even geographically. You know, they have a lot of free trade pacts with other countries. But now I think Chile will be closer to Mercosul, which is, you know, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay and Argentina. So I think that's going to be quite an interesting relationship in the next few years.
It'll be the first time after her inauguration, it'll be the first time that Latin America will have four countries with a woman in power.
That's very exciting. Brazil, Argentina, Costa Rica and Chile, which is quite a sizable number. I would say it's probably the region of the world with the highest number of female leaders, which is quite an interesting thing.
Great news.
Now, staying with Chile slightly, one of the things that Michelle Bachelet has said that she will look at is legalizing abortion. Do you think that this is directly to do with the fact that there are women in charge? And what's the situation in Brazil?
Absolutely. You know, and it's funny because Chile used to be one of the most socially conservative countries in the region. But now they're kind of progressing very, very rapidly. And it's interesting that Bachelet, you know, in terms of abortion rights, she's the first one that's kind of was very open about it. Because, for example, in Brazil, I think Dilma deep inside, she is pro-choice, you know, but Brazil, because it's a very Catholic country, like the whole region, so it's quite a difficult thing to approve. But for example, we have a lot of exceptions. For example, if the woman is raped or if there's a problem with the pregnancy, so it's not that you can't do an abortion. And I wouldn't say that if you do an abortion, you go to jail. I never heard any story like that. But, you know, I hope the law will change very fast in the other countries in South America.
Let's move on to other stories that you've picked out for us. And O Globo has dedicated its front page to the north-south divide in Brazil.
Yeah, it's a very interesting and fairly positive front page as well. It's a kind of an analysis of families in the north and south of Brazil. And it's saying that the families overall, they have more money, but they're also more in debt too. Because unemployment rates in the country are at the lowest point in 11 years. Mm-hmm. And even though our economy is not doing that well, I think still the money inside the families is kind of growing every year. And, you know, there's some interesting examples here. For example, there's this story about the domestic worker. She doesn't earn that much, but she just managed to change her car, which used to be a Chevette car from 84 to a Gol 92. You know, it's some sort of progress. And then there's another story here in the middle. Vanessa Lima, she was fired. And after only 5 days, she got a new job. And she's getting paid 20% more. So it's kind of an interesting analysis of the Brazilian family. And one of the reasons as well, that in Brazil, you can pay everything with installments. So I think it's one of the few countries in the world that you can do that. And even...
Just how widespread is that? I mean, I was reading that in your notes on the piece, the fact that everything is paid for on the never-never, as we would call it.
Yes, including luxury brands. If you go to Louis Vuitton, to Hermes, you can pay installments. And I think they made an exception, because I don't think they do this in other countries. But they understood that if they didn't do that in Brazil, it wouldn't work. They wouldn't be successful. So that's quite an interesting characteristic.
And how much concern is there that by getting yourself into debt, you're saving up problems for the future?
Well, that's one of our biggest problems. Because, I mean, as the story said, you know, the families are earning more overall, but basically almost everyone is in debt somehow. Mm. So maybe I hope this bubble doesn't explode in the next few years.
Sure. Well, with the economy on the up, it looks like a happy Christmas is on the cards for a lot of people. Now, O Globo's got a piece about, it's a little Christmas special actually, isn't it?
It's a little Christmas special on how Christmas is changing, you know. Instead of the traditional Christmas, you have like these new trends. Like instead of the usual Christmas decorations, you have tropical fruits in your Christmas tree. I would love that, actually.
Well, it's nice to see because, you know, Christmas, you could argue, is a northern hemispherical invention where things get very wintry for the season. And, you know, spare a thought for those poor people who were talking to in New Zealand earlier who have to endure Christmas in the sunshine. And you kind of have this incongruous mix of, you know, fir trees on the beach and kind of spray snow on the windows while actually it's sunny outside.
We're trying to change, you know. For example, when I'm in São Paulo during Christmas, sometimes you see some Santas like wearing some shorts, you know, sometimes they're even shirtless, but they still have the
sexy
beard.
Sexy Santas. Do they still have the big pot belly?
They still have the
beard.
Belly and they still have the presents.
Oh,
and
keep the Santa suit on. Fernando,
Santa's got a six pack.
I wanted to ask you about that though, because growing up in Africa, of course, my Christmases were completely different, but people still tended to have kind of turkeys and things, although sometimes on the barbecue. So how is it done in Brazil?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we still have the same traditional stuff as here. It's, to be honest, there's not much difference in a way. Well, of course, the weather, there's a big difference, but we do like a big party. And because, you know, Brazil, again, is a very Catholic country, so we celebrate Christmas a lot. If you walk around the streets, there's so much Christmas decoration. Sometimes, I mean, more than in European countries, in my opinion, I have to say.
And talk to us about this story in more detail. So we're seeing tropical fruit being hung on the Christmas trees and gluten-free panettones.
Exactly, for those who are healthy conscious.
And an amazing
and
Christmas
pink.
Lights.
Yeah, and pink. Pink is back as
pink.
Well.
Pink for Christmas.
Your Christmas decoration should be pink, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, because white lights, they're so out of fashion anymore. This kind of minimalism is over.
Do you know, I went out shopping with a friend of mine the other day to buy a Christmas tree, and all the shops we went to, there were no red baubles, there were no gold baubles left. The only ones they had left were kind of turquoise and kind of luminous pink and purple. I said purple was nice. Purple feels Christmassy, kind of.
Does
More
it?
So than luminous pink or turquoise.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. And in fact, I think I'd quite like to look at your tree.
It's not my tree, it was his tree.
Just add a pineapple and a banana on your tree. Just
a banana on the tree.
That's all you need. Now, listen, very quickly, let's just talk about the television show that is really sweeping the nation in Brazil. That's The Voice.
The Voice Brazil. It's very funny that Brazil is. It took a long time to have like a proper successful music reality show. But now The Voice Brazil, everybody's talking about, it's the most chatted show about, more even than the soap operas at the moment. And mainly because of the judges, because now you have proper Brazilian musicians, very famous ones like Carlinhos Brown, Claudia Leitte and Lulu Santos. And they are the main reason why the program is so successful. But there's been some critics, you know. Apparently, João Gilberto, our Bossa Nova king, he wouldn't be successful in the show because you have to scream to win, like a Mariah Carey.
Should we really be celebrating the success of, you know, shows like that in Brazil? I mean, maybe that was the last bastion of proper scripted television.
Yeah, maybe you'll never hear like a softer tone of Bossa Nova. You know, the critics were saying that you as I say, you have to scream like Mariah Carey. A lovely Bossa Nova song wouldn't be successful in this show.
I wouldn't like to listen to that.
Yeah, but it is successful.
Fernando, thank you very much indeed. That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid.
Thanks to our producer, Alid John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, still here, thanking him in person. Not forgetting Jamie McConkie. Our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Up next, after the news, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. But stay tuned for The Briefing, which is on air at 1200 hours in London this afternoon, 700 hours if you're listening in New York. Emma Nelson will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, for me, Tig Enright.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. Its dead men faster. Further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.